Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute, either explicitly or implicitly, any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. We've got a great show for you today. I'm Brett Winton. I'm the host and chief futurist at ARK Invest. With me today, I have Frank Downing, who's the director of research in the next generation internet space for us and really focuses on artificial intelligence as well as smart contracting side. Hi, Frank. How are you?
Hey, Brett. Doing well.
And today we're going to interview Keith Wittig, who is the chief operating officer of TensTorrent, a chip startup competing against the likes of NVIDIA. So, Frank, why are we interested in kind of the AI chip space generally? What's our view of the direction that market is going to go?
Yeah, happy to walk through this because I think it's really important conversation for this wide-ranging discussion that we had with Keith. I'll start from the very kind of top down first, which is before we even get to why we want AI chips, why do we think AI is important? And the way that we size this market is looking at what we do every day for work, which is knowledge work. And we're seeing generative AI in particular coming in as this new technology. It's been in the works for a long time, but this new technology that has the potential to dramatically increase the productivity of virtually all kinds of knowledge work, really for the first time. So we think this is a dramatic increase in capability across 1 billion knowledge workers globally that get paid $30 trillion in annual wages. And if you think of AI software as a tool to increase the productivity of those knowledge workers, you can start to see a market for enterprises paying for solutions, either software or building their own, to basically drive this productivity increase. And they're really augmenting, or in some cases replacing, this body of $30 trillion in annual spend. So we think what this breaks down to is around $14 trillion in spend on software, either buying it from a software provider or building it in-house or doing some combination on an infrastructure as a service platform. That will be a growing market now through 2030. And to actually power all of this new AI software, we're going to need a new generation of computing platforms to actually support that. It's similar to when we transitioned from the PC to mobile. We needed a new generation of chips to power smartphones because the existing chips weren't actually set up architecturally to power smartphones. They were better for things that were expected to be plugged in all day at your desk. So thinking about a $14 trillion software market, if you back out the gross margins all the way through kind of the stack of the cloud and enterprise software vendors, you start to underwrite a multi-trillion dollar market for AI compute. And that's really where the story with TensTorrent begins. We know we're going to have kind of we project in our research, multi-trillion dollar compute market by 2030. And the funny thing here is that Keith is in this industry. He has lived it his whole life. And he's talking in this conversation about a $400 billion market by 2030 and thinking that seems like a lot. Our research would suggest it could be much bigger than that. And that's why this is a really important topic to pay attention to.
Great. Yes. And fully endorsed. And actually, even Microsoft just, you know, recently they announced a new laptop, was it, with like an AI-specific chip. Like you can see how at the data center level and at the endpoint device level, we're going to need a new class of chips to kind of efficiently power these things. And in your smart glasses and in your smart speakers. And so it actually would be a great surprise if the existing, if Intel won in that market, for example, but nobody thinks Intel is going to, but even kind of ARM's positioning in the mobile ecosystem could be up for grabs to some degree because kind of the underlying performance you need out of these systems is changing. Speaking of ARM, can you lay out kind of like what is the state of play in the ecosystem today that we think is going to be shaken up and displaced?
Yeah, good question, because it's a complex ecosystem that's kind of important to understand, at least at like a basic level. So because starting at the end market, you have companies that have some use case that need compute. So it could be, Meta needs compute to power Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp, for example. And they will go to a vendor to provide that kind of compute system. I'll ignore the server manufacturers that are kind of just putting pieces together and just go, you know, consider the core compute engines of today. Intel, AMD making the primary CPUs that we see in our data centers and our computers. Qualcomm and Apple for our smartphones, and NVIDIA and AMD and a whole long tail of startups in the accelerator space, which is emerging as this kind of provider of the compute for the AI data center. And those companies build their own IP themselves. They design chips. They also license IP, in particular, and important to this conversation, what's called an instruction set architecture, which is really this fundamental layer that helps software communicate with the hardware. And in the CPU space, the predominant CPU architecture today is called x86, created by Intel, and they actually license that to AMD. So AMD and Intel, the CPU providers, both have x86-based chips. They are, at the margin, seeding way to ARM, which is a company that recently IPO'd this year that has a different instruction set architecture, which is called, it's a flavor of what's called RISC, which is reduced instruction set architecture. It has less instructions, which actually makes it much more power efficient. So ARM exists today as a large part because of the mobile smartphone proliferation, where x86 chips weren't power efficient enough to support devices that were battery powered. ARM was in the right place at the right time and became the dominant provider of instruction set architectures for mobile phones, and they still own 99.9% of that market. At the margin, we have a new instruction set architecture coming into the fold that's actually an open source alternative. So one of the common complaints that Keith alludes to in this conversation is there is extremely strong vendor lock-in. Once you build on top of an instruction set architecture, it's historically very hard to get off of it. And so as we have this explosion in demand of compute, companies want to more and more control their own destiny. So they want to be able to control their instruction set. It's this kind of importance is what's led ARM to be suing Qualcomm, their largest customer. So there's a lot of tension and history here. And what TensorRT is doing is building on top of what's called RISC-V, which is essentially an open source version of ARM, is a good way to think of it. So it's a much more power efficient architecture that can be used on endpoint devices, but also like ARM is getting pulled into data centers by companies like Amazon. RISC-V can also power data center CPUs and be used to some extent in AI accelerators as well. So that's, you know, we've gone from the kind of end compute consumer to the core companies designing and selling chips to the instruction sets that and IP that power them. The last layer that's important for this conversation, it goes farther back in the supply chain, are the actual manufacturers of chips or the fabricators. The primary ones are TSMC and Samsung, as well as GlobalFoundries, which is another fab that actually spun out from AMD, which is important for this conversation because Keith used to work with AMD. So that's a lot, but hopefully a good breakdown of like the very high level of the kind of this part of the chip ecosystem that's relevant today.
Okay, great. And then TensorRT itself, like, why is this an interesting exposure and conversation for us generally? So they're building on RISC-V, and kind of what is their AI play and how does that compare to what NVIDIA is doing?
Yeah, great question. And there's a few interesting points here. We think the market, and generally I think the market thinks the market for AI compute is going to be very large. And NVIDIA is in the pole position. They're definitely in first place. They are winning the market right now, and they have a large opportunity to go after. And the fact of the matter is that the market's growing so fast, they can't supply the entire market. So this opens up room for startups, for other companies like AMD, for example, to sell into parts of the market that NVIDIA just can't satisfy right now. And in doing so, might be able to come up with new architectures that are actually more efficient because they're starting from the ground up. So a good example is that the existing chips today use a large amount of high bandwidth memory. That's powerful, but it also literally consumes power and has a supply chain constraint. And when you're starting with a net new architecture, you can be more efficient about how a chip uses memory to reduce that dependence. And TensorRT is doing that. So they're starting from the ground up, building on top of an open ecosystem that benefits them, one, from kind of flexibility and customizability, but also benefits them because their customers feel a bit burned by being locked into NVIDIA's architecture, by being locked into ARM's architecture, and they want to be able to control their own destiny more. And so for a company that's willing to both build on an open stack, contribute to an open stack, and actually license out their IP, even if you don't want to buy their actual chip, that's a really unique value proposition that very few others, none that I know of, are actually going after in the space, kind of building on an open ecosystem that they can contribute to, kind of inherent from the development in open source, because this is a growing problem that everybody in the industry sees. And those that aren't the current incumbents want to build and support RISC-V. So TensorRT benefits from those kind of natural tailwinds.
Great. Yeah. So, and Keith has a lot of perspective in the industry. He worked at AMD in a senior role for a long time, I think around 14 years, and then worked at Google with their endpoint device development, worked at Tesla with Jim Keller, who's the CEO of TensorRT and is now the COO at TensorRT and really running kind of like their business development strategy and operations and sales. I hope everybody enjoys the conversation. Frank, thanks so much for providing the illuminating perspective, and enjoy the show. Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. Keith Wittig, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
So you have like a long, you know, more than 20-year history in the chip space, AMD for a long time in a senior role, Google, Tesla, and working with RISC-V, with Sci-5. So a lot of history. And now you're at TensorRT. Given all of the gory history you've experienced, why get into another chip company and why TensorRT?
I actually moved to Tesla and continued the journey with Google because I wanted to step out of a pure silicon semiconductor role. I wanted to get system experience. I wanted to be where that power base was going in the market, these trillion-dollar valued companies that are developing complex solutions that are going straight to the customer. I wanted to learn that space. And what I thought was, and I thought wrongly, obviously, when you see the stock market valuations, I said, oh, semiconductors, it's a mature market. You know, how much higher can these market caps go? I mean, what usually happens is you go on a fade after the industry matures. I want to get into where the excitement is. And then lo and behold, you know, 8-10 years later, semiconductors goes on a tear again. And I'm like, I learned systems. Semiconductors is what I really know. I'm going back to my knitting. I head back into semiconductors and help this new whole generation of AI compute happen. It's going to be a great roller coaster ride. So I jump back on.
Well, could you describe like TensorRT specifically? So you're COO at TensorRT. What is TensorRT and why? Like, there's a whole history of chip startups that has died and withered and crippled. Yeah. Why is TensorRT different?
Yeah. So TensorRT was started by a bunch of smart folks up in Toronto that came out of AMD. They said when 2012 happened and the new AI hype cycle, the fourth one as it would turn out in our industry happened, some rapid things happened leading up to my personal journey was 2016, 2017, where I realized at Tesla, AI was the real deal. This was not hype. This is going to change markets. And then I started talking with my friends about, okay, you guys in fintech, you guys in pharmaceuticals, retail, you know, other markets, what do you guys think about? They all said it's profound. It's a changing the way we do business. So you knew it was here to stay. So then I thought, okay, if AI is real and high performance compute is real, where do you go and how do you contribute? And I said, I'll go to TensorRT. And I picked TensorRT because of a few factors. It's a great team. The team that Jim Keller has assembled here, when you go look at what they did at Apple or DEC, IBM, Intel, NVIDIA, AMD, other companies, Qualcomm, they've won the World Series of developing high-tech platforms 85 times. So they're going to do it again. Now, or at least they're going to have a much better probability of doing it than other teams. So I said, okay, that's the right place to be. So one of the things about Tenstorrent that makes us different is the success rate of this team. We didn't jump into blockchain because blockchain was cool. No, we've been doing it for 35 years and with a good track record, right? And very large companies that know how to do this. And then they have a technology viewpoint, I think, that's very spot on to where the workloads are going, is one engine doesn't get the job done anymore. It used to be you could do everything on a CPU. If you have graphics in your box, do it with the graphics processor. It seems now like transportation. Sometimes you need a bike, sometimes you need an airplane, sometimes a bus, sometimes a boat, sometimes a train. You need different engines to do different jobs. I believe Tenstorrent can weave those engines together better than anybody else. We saw NVIDIA, which is a parallel compute graphics company for the most part, struggle at Project Denver. You see Intel struggling at some of the same stuff. When I was at Google, turning a internet software company into a, you know, hardware company, it's hard. This team knows how to put multiple different engines together, make it run well, and give the customers what they need with the new LLMs and transformers and other algorithms that are coming to market. And then lastly, I would say, use the example of Dell. Dell made billionaires walking around here in Austin, Texas around me, not by building better technology, but by being smarter about the business model. And they didn't have access to any new technology, but they won with a business model. And our business model is open. You want access to the technology. You don't want a monopoly to raise price on you at any time. You want sovereignty. It's in your hands. A politician can't sign a bill saying you don't get access to the technology anymore. We can make that happen with our open RISC-V and AI platforms. Proprietary platforms won't allow you to do that. So we're getting a lot of traction from that.
Yeah. Can you explain the NVIDIA point a little bit more? Because I think an outsider looking in would say, just like you were thinking AI is the future in 2016, NVIDIA has been doing this for 10 plus years, focused on AI in the data center. And they seem like they're winning right now. What's the nuance there?
Yeah. You know, and I would say, first off, anybody who comes in with, hey, we're going to beat NVIDIA and NVIDIA's making all these mistakes, they're a fool. NVIDIA is a great company. They're going to go down in history as one of the best companies I think the high-tech business has ever produced. If not, it's not over. Maybe they'll be the best in the end, right? So they're a great company and Jensen is a great leader. They're thoughtful. They can move. They can pivot. Most companies can't do that. I will say, though, you don't have to believe my words. You can believe history. The IBM 360, they thought that was the shit. It's the best, right? It's going to do all the things everybody needs to do. You just got to pay me $25 million and you can get an IBM 360. And then Dell comes along and does the mini computer for $200,000 and IBM thinks they're an idiot and they win the business. And the PC comes along and who wants a PC in the home, right? And you have these shifts in the market. I will tell you today, I have a graph that shows it took the phone like 80 years to get to 150 million users. The TV, 37 years to get to 150 million users. You know how long it's taking for people to adopt ChatGPT? You know, they're getting to 150 million users in like 4 seconds, right? I mean, that's an exaggeration, but it's fast. So the world is changing faster now than ever before. And I think that's the challenge NVIDIA is going to face is you're big. You've invested billions and billions in the graphics cores. You were out first. You were the leader. You put 15 years into CUDA. Are you willing to change that and pivot when you're at the top of the mountain? It's innovator's dilemma. That's the one thing you have going for you. So these new graph computers or tensor computers that are coming out are very different from graphics processors. And I think most architects you ask today, even the ones at NVIDIA, if you were designing a product today, not going on the journey starting 10 years ago with what you had, but with all the papers published between 10 years ago and now, knowing what you know now, what would you build to power AI? They wouldn't tell you a graphics processor.
How different does the ideal chip look from like a TPU that Google's building or some of the other chip startups? Like how misplaced is NVIDIA's architecture and where does Tenstorrent fit into it?
Let me qualify that question a little bit. If you dissect the market into kind of like there are inference chips versus training chips, and then further dissect the market into there's training chips that are going in data centers, inference chips that allow you to run the models in the data centers, and then a whole set of chips that are probably going into endpoint devices that might be very customized. Yeah, how do you think about NVIDIA's positioning there versus what Tenstorrent's doing and its potential across those stacks? And and strategically the landscape generally.
Yeah. So you can carve the market up into dimensions. So let's start at the top. You have Lisa Su out there saying the market's going to be $400 billion in TAM by the end of the year by the end of the decade for hardware in the AI space. You have very conservative, pessimistic efforts around, well, we don't build enough fab capacity to make this happen, right? So it's only $100 billion. So somewhere, my guess is we're going to be probably around $200 billion in AI hardware sales in the next like 5 to 7 years, to call it end of the decade. If you start with that large of a market and you start carving it up, well, the blended gross margin of NVIDIA on the market is like about 72%, I believe, last I looked. They have recent earnings announcement, but I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. They probably print a lot of these H100 DGX boxes at higher margin than that, since it's a blended average. They have lower margin, higher margin parts. I'm sure their AI cutting edge products are higher margin. So let's call it 80% margin. You know, they're driving tens of billions of dollars annually in those products. You do not want to undermine that growth. And I think a lot built into their $2 trillion, or actually it's a $1.2 trillion market cap, probably going on its way to $2 trillion, right, is based on those financials continuing. So what do you want to build? You want to do what IBM was doing. You want to build the big, expensive, high-performance boxes with expensive HBM3 memory, silicon interposer and everything, large share of wallet, take it from your customers. That leaves, like Clayton Christensen's book, Innovator Dilemma, a lot of room at the bottom to come in with a more cost-effective, more performing product that you sell at, you know, a horrendous 50%, 55% gross margin to NVIDIA's financial model, and you go win and you get into those segments that they don't necessarily want to support. They also don't necessarily want to support tier two, tier three folks or markets that may be more of a pain to their opportunity cost than what they can drive. They at tens of billions in revenue aren't looking for a $500 million or $1 billion opportunity. They're looking for the next $25 billion opportunities. There aren't very many of those, and that's where they're probably going to focus. That would be a smart thing for Jensen to do when he's a smart leader. But Jim Keller and I, we can go focus on $5 billion opportunities and IPO this company with tremendous value. And people say, well, isn't that risky? Because won't NVIDIA just crush you on price? Why would you, and I use the example of AMD and Intel. AMD had a threshold for, Intel had a threshold for AMD on market share. You can have 20% of market share, AMD, and I won't bother you. You start getting to economies of scale where you can start threatening my core business and my core financial strength, and then I'm going to come after you. Nobody in a $200 billion market who's making $3 billion in revenue is even going to turn NVIDIA's head. They're not going to drop their gross margins from 82% to even 81% to try to combat that competitor. I don't believe it for a minute. They're going to keep trying to drive their business and climb. So, because why do I know that? That's not a belief. That's how history has played out. And the financial, you know, geniuses at the time played it out. I don't think it's changed. You don't drop your price to compete with somebody who's less than 1% of the market. So I think there's plenty of room here to make money. And I think that's what we're going to do. So people say, how are you going to compete with NVIDIA? We're not. We're going to go win and we're going to build other moats that they're not interested in. But that will take us to an IPO very easily.
Another way to say this, like outside of the, you know, the technical architecture component, is that the opportunity size is quite large and NVIDIA is going to go after the big chunk of it that they're very well positioned for, but they're going to, by necessity, create opportunities for smaller companies doing something different and innovative like TensorTorrent to also grow and become meaningful in kind of this long-term future state.
I think that's right. I think that's naturally how everything progresses. You look at, you know, all the x86 companies that existed back in the day, eventually they all consolidated out. You know, long historical trends favor scale and consolidation. That's in the tech business, that's generally been true. So I think that'll happen. It's not going to happen for the next 5 or 10 years. I think there's a huge sandbox and playground for companies with good technology and novel business models, you know, handling certain segments that are uninteresting to the big guys. I think there's a huge opportunity for those companies to make their name in the business.
Can you explain a little bit about, you know, these components of TensorTorrent's business? And I'll just say RISC-V CPU versus AI accelerator and how that's differentiated and how it gives you kind of this optionality relative to some of the others in the space.
Oh, that's another great question. It's every time I see something other people aren't doing, I get worried maybe you're the crazy one, right? And I've asked myself this question over and over again, because when you look at the competitors on the RISC-V side of the business, they're all RISC-V and they don't care about AI. Now that's changing now because of the multiples that are in AI. You see the announcements Arm has made saying we're an AI company now. They like the multiples of the better business, and that's a rational thing for their C-suite to be thinking. But then you look at the AI guys and they're thinking, well, I'm an AI guy. Why do I care about, you know, CPUs and Xeon and ARM Cortex processors? One truth I learned in this business, and I mentioned it earlier in this interview, is you need more than one engine to get the job done. And we learned that at AMD when AMD bought ATI way back in the mid-2000s. And then that was a difficult transition for a while. But eventually, I think the company has proved out that if you could do multiple compute engines with the right fabric, feeding the beast properly, with the right memory subsystem so the data is there and can be presented to these controllers, with the right architecture, meaning you could pass pointers between these guys to transfer workloads and do things efficiently from the compiler without having to do memory moves and expensive processes to get these two engines to talk with each other. If you do the architecture right, that engine is going to be way more capable than anything else. If you have parked in your driveway a Ferrari sports car and a minivan, you're more flexible, better off at handling life's transport situations than the guy who just has one of those two cars parked in their driveway. And that's what we're doing here. And it shocks me more people haven't figured that out, because it's proven to be the case. Even NVIDIA has been going down that path for a while. AMD is certainly there. Intel's on its way. It's clear today to me that the market needs to move in this direction, and that's where we're going.
So just to clarify, specifically, it's saying you need like a CPU coupled with an accelerator so the CPU can allocate kind of resource to the accelerator that operates in parallel. And kind of like that full package is required to like successfully operate in market, right?
Or even run some operations in the AI algorithm, the stem of the AI algorithm. So you might have 96 different operations that have to happen start to finish as, you know, the frames of the cameras, the eight cameras on your Tesla Model 3 flowing through the algorithm get to the bottom and says, there's a bike there, there's a pedestrian there, there's a van there, a stoplight there. It has to go through a lot of different staged computations. Some of those may be better executed by a CPU. Some may be better executed by a really good vector unit. Some may be way better executed by AI tensor engine or graph computer with massively parallel multiply adder units. I think the answer is if you have that flexibility and there isn't a great amount of overhead and loss for providing that flexibility to the workload and the customer, you're better off offering that flexibility.
What's interesting, I think, about TensorTorrent relative to, or an interesting thing about TensorTorrent relative to the way NVIDIA set up and the way AMD is trying to set up, is there, you do offer the end customer much more flexibility about how they allocate workload to the chips, right? In terms of like, NVIDIA has CUDA, which as I understand it, it means that developers can take kind of like their development and effectively fill up the transistors in their chip relatively efficiently, or they have an easy way to fill up the transistors in the chip with parallel operations. You have an open source version of CUDA. Is that the right way to think about it? To allow people to more kind of efficiently optimize their workloads across the chips that you offer?
Yeah, we've open sourced two compiler stacks. We call it Metallium and Buda. Metallium is more like CUDA. Buda is an engine that compiles top down, you know, TensorFlow, PyTorch, Onyx, JAX into, you push a button and you get compile it. The same journey that was taken in CPU from the early days of everybody, I'm old, right? I'm old. So back in the day, I would write code on assembly language direct to Intel TI processors or VAX machines. Why? Because the compilers were terrible. They were inefficient. So eventually the compilers got so good for back in that day, you know, Pascal and Fortran and C and C++, you eventually started taking the efficiency the compilers offered you, programming higher level languages and not messing around with the details of hand packing code and assembly language. I think the same thing is probably going to be the trend for AI. We're not there yet. And who knows, could be 2 years, could be 5 years. But I think the compilers will eventually get smart enough and the disruptions in the algorithms and architectures will slow enough over time, will get stable, where those compilers will be great and you'll start using them. But even then, having the compilers be able to say, this algorithm needs to run on a CPU, not a neural net, not an AI engine, not a tensor computer, not a graphics core, you know, not a vector unit. Or in a different dimension, this needs to run on a different unit because I've seen it run better on that before. And that's the way I've learned over time to assign algorithmic constructs to the hardware. I think that's going to be very effective and necessary to be really, really efficient in future workloads. So the CPU doesn't just kind of help with the traffic, with the traffic jam. The CPU is actually going to be an active engine that participates in AI when it needs to. And plus, it serves another purpose. When sometimes AI engines can be too targeted to a specific task. And if 2 months from now, Google puts out a paper or Microsoft puts out a paper and it's like, this is a way better algorithm, people who don't allow enough flexibility in their hardware all of a sudden go, crap, my entire $6 billion in CapEx is worthless now compared to competitors who are buying their CapEx now with this better machine. So you do want some assets that can pick up tweaks, diversity, you know, different things in the workloads and algorithms that are changing over time. Generally, a CPU does that better. Net, it won't be parallel, it'll do it slower, but it allows you some recovery flexibility.
Yeah, there's kind of like a spectrum of you want to specialize because you get better performance, but if you over-specialize, then you can't be as flexible to changing workloads, which could lead you totally mispositioned for how things are changing. And right now, things are changing extremely quickly in AI workloads.
That is spot on.
Maybe taking a step back, you said you open sourced your compilers. Like, could you talk about building one, open sourcing things yourself, but also building on open source in general with respect to kind of choosing RISC-V for your cores?
Yeah, so we have RISC-V. Let me make sure I understand your question. So the software, the compilers that we have are open source. RISC-V is an open architecture. We obviously have a micro architecture we've created from that standard that doesn't necessarily have to be open source. So when you say, how do you do innovation and an ecosystem and development in open source, do you mean the compiler software space or do you mean the hardware like RISC-V AI space or both?
Both, but let's just go with the RISC-V for now.
RISC-V. All right. So I think the RVI standard that's out right now is, I think, numbered 24. I think most people are developing to that standard. The good thing is you can deviate from that standard if you choose to do so. You can grab RISC-V technology on the open source tree. You can develop it yourself. Nobody can stop you with that fundamental architecture because it's open. And then if you choose to stay within the confines of the standard, you're okay. The whole ecosystem is there for you. Testers, debuggers, bootloaders, operating systems, compilers, everything is there for you. Peripheral IP, it'll work well, a security subsystem. So that IP is being developed. And the great thing, and then well, let me finish that thought and then I'll go on to this next thought. And if you choose to deviate off that plan and do something very targeted for your use, kind of branch the tree down a path that everybody else is not following, there's pros and cons to that, but I will tell you, buying product off the shelf from in proprietary systems, buying what ARM is willing to give you or what NVIDIA, Intel, AMD, they're willing to give you, and there is no other choice. You don't get to change it. There's nothing in the equation that allows you to do that. Having the option and the ability to branch down a path if you value it as such, if the benefit of that is way, way bigger than the pain that could cause you, that's a choice. One of the things I've learned in my career, executives who have choices are generally more happy than executives who don't have choices. So, so you give people that opportunity in open source. The other thing is with open source, you get a lot of development that you're not paying OpEx for. They're coming in, they're helping, they're contributing. And I just looked at the data, doing another business review for our board meeting coming up next month. And if you look at the data, Jim Keller likes to say it this way, open source is a one-way door. When you look at the progression of Android, you look at the progression of Linux, it starts out where it starts out, zero. And then you see this funnel growing and it starts going, and nobody's going back. Everybody's going into open source and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, Android takes 70% of the market. We've seen what Linux has done over time. So I think the same dynamic is likely to happen over time with open source. Once people get that benefit of that business model, a government can't take it away from you. A monopoly can't raise price on you 6 times in 1 year. You get to make the changes you want to make. You get free, basically free, ecosystem support from other folks as you need it and see fit. Those benefits, once you go to them, once you go from the existence you had before in a proprietary ecosystem to the freedom you have in an open source community, most people don't go back. And I say that too. It's the other thing I tell people that is misunderstood. People say, well, how are you ever going to make money? It's open source. I'll make money because Red Hat was sold for $34 billion to IBM. Open source doesn't mean free. Open source means freedom, right? There's a big difference.
Yeah. One of the theories that I 100% agree with and endorse that. And then it seems like structurally now within the AI space, a theory we have both internally and we've published it is kind of like there could be a fracturing of the hardware software ecosystem broadly. And definitely like at the end use applications, it's clear you're going to have all kinds of different systems using AI to kind of accelerate performance, everything from Tesla vehicles to drones to, you know, robots, humanoid robots, robot arms, like, you know, hospital systems, who knows, like, so there's going to be a huge variety of kind of like end users where kind of like they are actually, you know, performing on chips that are very kind of probably tuned to the AI engine that's driving them. And also, you know, those will require probably different model sets. And so it just seems like there's going to be a huge fracturing of what needs to happen to drive optimum performance. And then it really provides a transition and kind of like what the underlying chip hardware could and should look like and would tend to lend itself towards, hey, and here's like open source tooling on top of this. So it can be adapted into end applications more completely than it otherwise would. Is that like a, and does that match kind of how TenseTorrent is selling into customers or thinking about markets? Or is that, that's going to happen, but it's happening later. We're not seeing evidence yet.
No, that is an age-old struggle that I don't know if anybody's going to be able to optimally solve for. You know, kind of like I love a quote by, you know, Thomas Sowell, you know, there's only trade-offs, there are no solutions. Right, which I think is very true, especially in many aspects of business. So what you said is absolutely right. What you need for the IoT embedded and mobile market is, above anything, probably power consumption, and then probably form factor. It needs to fit into a watch or smaller space. Then it could be cost, because these devices are cost sensitive. I can go through all of the markets between here and the other bookend probably being data center, where it's like, it's all about power and performance. For the most part, everybody cares about the dollars, but they're less cost sensitive. Melt the polar ice caps, we don't care. Just get the workloads done fast so I can make a lot of money off the CapEx I've invested. It's a very different environment. So when you look at people that are selling the picks and shovels into that market, you'd like to sell a pick and shovel to the market for each and every kind of user as they're going and making these things happen. That is not an easy thing to solve. Right? If you try to do everything for everybody, usually you're making a mediocre product in a lot of different areas and you're spread too thin. You have to pick your battles. The game that needs to be played and played well is, for your resources, your competencies, the IP you have, did you maximize your approach to the market and your development of technology to have as much reuse and mutual gain in as many products and markets and customer spaces and verticals as you possibly can? It's an optimization problem, and it's not an easy one. And you always have to leave something off the table. Now, we've struggled with that. We've tried to make our architecture so that it scales. We announced an LG collaboration in the press back in May. Our lowest performing product was like 276 teraops. They said, I'm not putting that into, you know, a TV or home electronics. I don't need that. It's like, you know, putting an 8,000 horsepower engine into a VW bug. So they're like, not going to do it. So our architecture was modular enough and our software flexible enough that they could jointly develop with us some technology that has a good chance of being ideally suited for TVs. At the same time, we have high-performance compute data center guys saying, I need a lot more performance than that. Can you give it to me? Yes, we can scale with that. And we're doing that with our RISC-V cores too. Do you have an architecture that can do two-way out-of-order cores, up to eight-way out-of-order cores, and scale it and derive it, get FUSA automotive requirements into a derivative of that? How easy is that to do? And if it's not easy, it's expensive. And at the end, the asset you look at is suboptimal. You're not going to win in the market. So the game is, how do you maximize that ROI with the resources you have? And then don't overextend and stop before you start getting to the point of mediocrity everywhere. I don't know if any company has a, you know, secret sauce on how to do that well, but it's a challenge for everybody. But we think we have a fairly flexible architecture where others don't. Like you mentioned earlier, Brett, there's training, there's inference. Some of them go, forget it, I'm just going to do training. And that's where the high margin devices are. Maybe the volume won't be there, but I'm going to print money. Not necessarily a bad strategy. It's a rational strategy.
How do you think about the model of selling in chips versus licensing IP? Like ARM got to the spot that it was just on a licensing business, up until a certain point. How do you think about TenStorrent's positioning there? And can both of those live in parallel? Is one model likely to dominate the other?
Yeah, that is another really, really astute, good question. I think we as businesses become slaves to the path we've traveled and slaves to the success we've gotten to. Because you've climbed to the mountain to that point, it doesn't make sense for you to go back in time and, or even from this day forward, climb the mountain in a different way. In fact, it might be impossible. And we've talked about it a little bit already in this interview. So for example, ARM went down a path of licensing IP. They built an engine, a brand, a revenue stream, assets, all about, we are neutral Switzerland. That's who we are. We've been that for 25 years. You know you can trust us. You know we're good. Adopt us. We're going to build a supply chain. We're neutral Switzerland. We'll sell you CPU cores and other IP. They're the most successful person on the planet driving that licensing business. I think they're approaching like $3 billion or more in revenue now, biggest by far than anybody else out there doing raw IP. And now they want to, if they want to start building silicon or pivoting that business model, it's incredibly difficult for them to do. They've painted themselves successfully into a very, very different corner. And moving from that means they're going to suffer harm on the $3 billion they've accumulated to move into a pivot into a different direction, right? NVIDIA, they've built a tens and tens of billions of dollars of business by quarter at, you know, 72% mixed gross margin. They're not going to start licensing business with the hope of someday having that licensing business be as big as ARM at $3 billion. $3 billion is a rounding error for them, even at 97% gross margin and maybe a 40% operating income. Why would they do that? They're cannibalizing the business they've successfully driven for the last 20 years. So they are a slave in many ways to the success that they have. So pivoting between those two businesses is hard. So you say, well, why can TenStorrent do both? Because we're starting that journey from the beginning. And the truth is, there's companies out there like Tesla and Google that'll say, Google will say, I've got great AI IP. I don't have right now any RISC-V IP. You're making pretty good RISC-V IP. I've got, you know, thousands of engineers that know how to make silicon on the inside. I don't want to buy your stuff. Put a middleman in between me and my cloud or me and my Pixel phone that takes 55, 60% gross margin off these chips. I'm going to build them myself. So I got the economies of scale soon, like Apple, to make that worth my while. I will not buy your off-the-shelf part. So in those cases, you have to license these guys your technology, or that contribution to your TAM is, or SAM is zero. And then you have people that want to buy chips, and then you have people that don't want to deal with semiconductors. They want to buy boxes and just plug and play into their business and run workloads. So we're doing all of those things. They're so far, what we've seen from our sales funnel is they don't cannibalize us. Like, for example, if you're going to go to a company that has 5G modems and they want to buy your AI and couple it with 5G and go to market, I don't have a 5G modem. So either they're going to find a different way to do this that's not me, they'll do it themselves and I'll lose business, or enable that company to combine my technology with their 5G modem and go to market, and it'll never be a channel conflict to me. So for me, I'm not a slave to past success. We don't have a past journey we've taken. And so what I'm doing is looking at all the business models, optimizing ROI without upsetting customers. And it turns out, if you start from that point and build your business on that basis from that starting point, when you get to $15 billion in sales, $70 billion in sales, you built from that premise, you can maintain that premise, And if you build to 70 million or 70 billion in sales on a different premise, sometimes you're stuck in the square on the chessboard you wound up at. And that's the reality of these business journeys these companies have taken.
But conceptually, you could end up, like, it could be that one of those two business lines is just more successful than the other in the way that you're positioned. And you could, it's not a bad, getting to $3 billion in IP is not run rate. It would not be a bad outcome, right? I mean,
no, not at those ARM multiples, which are deserved given their margins and the longevity of their revenue stream. I mean, if ARM went out of business today, they shut everything down, but they just had contracts go on and revenues come in, they'll continue to collect revenue for another 10 years on royalty contracts they have out with everybody. It is that long tail of business that's locked and loaded and secure that has these guys trading at like 40x or 35x revenue. It is a great business model if you can get there, but the top line revenue opportunity isn't there. So we're trying to blend these to service different customers who are, it's binary. They're either going to be your customer or not. And whether they're your customer or not depends on what business model you engage with them on with your IP and your technology, your chips and your boxes. If you can do all of it and do it without crushing overhead and cost and support burden, you're optimizing your ROI and profit. You're also setting yourself up for what you just said, Brett, that if the future for us is licensing is better, you pivot to that and you still IPO and you return handsome returns and multiples to your investor. If it's build boxes, IP is not our cup of tea anymore, we're even more successful. So it almost provides alternative courses of future action that de-risk your business. And most mature companies don't have that option.
Is there still disruption that can happen to that existing revenue base for ARM? Like, I'm thinking of RISC-V mobile CPU, or even like all the major clouds now have their own ARM-based CPU that's either in production with AWS or kind of ramping to production with the others. It's a small part of ARM's business relative to mobile, but that creep in and eat away at kind of what they have, which is in mobile, 100% market share. Or is what you're saying, that'll happen, but it'll take time?
That, when you say that will happen, you mean growth of the RISC-V market into what may be some of their core businesses?
Yeah.
It will definitely take time. You know, the companies that experience these kind of shifts, be it technology disruption, business disruption, financial disruption, geopolitical, whatever, they don't Enron or Lehman Brothers overnight, right? Usually it's, wow, 5-10 year struggle. We're seeing an example of that play out in the public sphere right now with Intel, right? I never thought, if you'd have rewound 10 years back and said Intel would be struggling the way they are right now, I would have said you're insane. That'll never happen, right? But it's taken 5 or 10 years for them to start seeing the pain, and their revenue line has actually tipped over. I think their best year was 2021, and now it's headed in the other direction. So Pat has his work cut out for him. He's a good leader. I'm sure he'll do what he can. But I think a lot of that is going to be what ARM and others could experience in the future, especially if they're not careful executing to very thoughtful strategies today. ARM has climbed to the top of the mountain in some of their markets from a market share perspective, as you noted, 99.99% TAM in cell phones. You can't grow anymore from there. And everybody's going to try to come in with better solutions, either in business model, technology, something, to knock you off that pedestal. You're number one. Of course, they're going to come after you. And the thing is it's easier for people to switch now. Just giving you a quick example, most people think the transition from Intel x86 to AMD x86 in the data center was easy because they were both x86, but it's not true. It was painful as hell. I was at AMD doing this with trying to get Dell to buy our processors and other things. And I'm no expert in software, but what I heard from the people who are experts is that there was a lot of proprietary software running in the data center that Intel was not going to let AMD have easy access to. In fact, it's the exact thing NVIDIA is doing to AMD right now by encrypting their math libraries and preventing a lot of this technology from being open and visible and usable and transparent to everybody, right? They're protecting the moat and their position. It's a smart move for them to do from their position. But basically, that transition from Intel to ARM that the data center took was painful, and then they did it. Then the AMD x86 platforms were transitioned on that open source technology that they now got the foundational element of. When they went to ARM, the transition from x86 to ARM was actually way easier. How easy is it going to be to transition AMD and ARM processors now to RISC-V? probably a lot easier than any of the other transitions before it. And that's what we're experiencing. And there's other examples of this. When you know, Apple's a very secretive company, obviously very successful, very good. But when you happen to, you know, every once in a while get an engineer from Apple with perhaps that's been there for 30 years with a little bit too much drink in them or something, you say, hey, you guys are really good. What was this transition like on your ICE? On your they said, look, the transition from PowerPC to, you know, x86 was pretty hard. You know, x86 to ARM, you know, a lot easier. And as a user, I didn't notice the difference. I had products from ARM that had PowerPC in them, that had x86 in them, and that had ARM in them. That company is so damn good at changing engines in their car as they're driving it down the road. None of us saw it change. The experience was amazing. They are the top gold standard of doing this. And they'll tell you it can be done. It gets easier every single time. I bet you, you know, I'm going to exaggerate a bit, but Apple could probably switch from ARM to RISC-V in 4.7 nanoseconds, and we wouldn't even know what happened, and we'd have a great experience on their devices, right? So this is the reality we live in today. And if I can give these customers a better business model, better financial choice, sovereignty and security, right, alternatives, a differentiated innovation pool, there's reasons to switch. It's not that difficult to do anymore.
It sounds like no one is safe and everybody's margin is your opportunity.
Absolutely. It's basically only the paranoid survive, right? Andy Grove was very right. And I just wish Intel would have lived by that after he left the company. We won't talk about Intel. I love the company. I almost went to work for them. It was a fluke. I didn't. I almost went to work for them coming directly out of college. They're the gold standard for 2 decades, at least, maybe 3 decades, right? So yeah, only the paranoid survive. Don't rest in your laurels. Jensen's not going to make that mistake. He's smart. The guy's always looking for changes in the business, and he's going in eyes open to things. Very good executive. So we'll see how he pivots in coming years.
Yeah. So since we won't talk about Intel, then you mentioned AMD, like pivoting gears a bit. Can you talk about this kind of rise of chiplet architecture, which I believe is something that AMD kind of pioneered? What's going on there, and what are kind of the broad implications?
No, that's another good question. It's chiplets. The chiplet journey, in my view, from my vantage point in the industry, is not new. It's not like this technology just came up in the last 3 years. If you're a student of history and you know this business really well and you look back in time, from my vantage point, multi-chip modules, which is what this was called, you know, back in the day, like 20 years ago, the FPGA companies, the field programmable gate array companies, in my opinion, hit this first. They said, we've got to pack a lot of programmable logic into a solution. We can't pack the logic we need on a single lithographic limited exposure on a die. We've got to break our design up into multiple pieces and then assemble it together to get our customers the level of logic they need to make our products useful. So these guys like, you know, Altera and Xilinx hit this wall first, and they came up with a lot of the early MCM technology, in my opinion. The next guys that hit that wall for a different reason were the DRAM guys. They were like, we have to put more and more increasing levels of memory storage into devices like watches and stuff. Man, we're going to have to 3D die stack this stuff, do multi-chip modules through silicon vias. We got to make this. So a whole nother dimension of this multi-chip ecosystem developed around the very high dollar, high volume business of DRAM. So it drove a decent development on the ecosystem. The next guys that hit this wall were the data center guys, and it was the NVIDIAs, the Intels, and the AMDs. Those devices started getting too big. And AMD had what I considered to be a unique problem. I remember being at AMD running Strategy 2008 in corporate development, leading corporate development, working with a few super, super bright, smart engineers. I think every single one of them, except for one, is still there. They said, we have one design team. Intel has like 5 design teams. When we focus our AMD design team on doing a great laptop part, Intel moves all the margin, like squeezing a balloon, off of laptop and into server and game consoles and other things. So you see Intel's revenue going up and to the right like nothing has changed, and they flatten out AMD's progress. Because everything that AMD invested in, they just took the oxygen out of the room of that market segment and moved the oxygen elsewhere. So AMD and, you know, Lisa Su, I believe, was there at the time. How do we address this? Well, a good way to address it would be make one design team punch way above their weight. How do you do that? Well, you make you architect a design that one of them is a tablet, two is a notebook, four is a PC, eight is a gaming PC, you know, then 16, 32, 64 could be servers. And you trade out different in that chiplet subsystem, you trade out different IO to service the various markets. You don't need SATA perhaps in a server part. You don't need 400 gigabit Ethernet in a tablet part, not yet. But you go build the devices that way. And it was a mess. I think, you know, we started talking about this heavily in 2008 with Bright Engineers, took Fiji, the first product using this to market in 2015, 7 years later. It wasn't easy. A lot of people were telling us we were idiots for even thinking about it, but they honed this ecosystem using this past technology from DRAM and others at the OSAT houses and at the foundries. And eventually, I think one of the three reasons why AMD, their stock went from like $1.86 to 3 months ago, it was $200, was because what you said, they had the courage and maybe even the forcing function and what they were facing with competition from Intel, you know, necessity to innovate here and win. And in the end, they stayed the course and did win. It wasn't easy. It was rough during the years I was there. But now I think it's one of the three reasons why they're an incredibly efficient company, giving great solutions to their customers and responding to the market faster. If you do this right, and then I'll shut up and let you guys talk. If you do this right, you can go to market with the right Legos of chiplets with a solution in 3 to 6 months. Monolithic custom silicon, start to finish, even if you don't make a new graphics architecture or a new CPU architecture, you're going to take 3 to 5 years. These markets are moving fast. The people who have high velocity of business and high velocity of development, like AMD, are much more likely to win.
So conceptually, but within like a chiplet future, call it, it would still be all of like the underlying components are being developed by the same company and then stitching them together, right? Rather than it being like totally modular, like the funny modular phone that failed, you know, where it's like, oh, I take this from this person and plug it in. You're thinking it still develops within the same, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another thing. You know, timing is everything as well. The Newton fails and then the iPad comes out, what, a decade later, and it's a smashing success. So yeah, the timing of the market matters. I think the technology, you know, the known good die losses, how we assemble these, how we ensure they can be properly tested, the thermals, the standards. It was a journey. I think we're there. But you raised an interesting point. How does the supply chain get affected by this? There's always going to be winners and losers. And I don't like even talking about this because when you talk publicly about this, change, even good change, is hard for people. Change that gores people's oxes is really hard because you know those companies, if they're powerful, are going to go after you. They'll try to get regulatory pass. They'll try to lock up supply chain. They'll try to do deals. Try to do something. So there is basically defensive things companies can do to slow the progress of technology that they don't like. It happens all the time, right? So chiplets, I think, is something that should net happen. But I'll give you one example of the tension in the supply chain. There's many examples. Again, I don't want to open people's eyes to too many of this because I don't want the resistance to start forming up in the industry. They're smart. It's already forming up, but I don't want to contribute to it. But I'll tell you this, one simple example. I just had this conversation this morning with a very, very smart venture capital investor in the semiconductor space out of Singapore. He goes, The OSAT companies don't want to invest in capital to keep up with multi-chip modules. They don't want to do the capital expenditure like TSMC and Samsung doing CoWoS and Info and other technology. And Samsung and TSMC might be like running away with this. And they're struggling to try to figure out, are they just going to be relegated to simple, low-margin packages in the future where there's no forward-looking innovation and growth in their market? They're just going to fade away? Or are they going to step up and capital invest? That's one tension point or fission point, fault line, if you will, that's forming up in the market as chiplets start to take over. There's at least three or four other big ones, right? One good one is an IP company like ARM, who's, like I said, when they were healthy, 97% gross margin, 30, 40% operating income, but they only have $3 billion in top line revenue. If they can get into the chiplet business and make silicon and they can be effective at that, Can their top line revenue go to $35 billion over the next 10 years, albeit at maybe 55, 60% gross margin? But are they throwing off a lot more dollars to pump into research and be the company they want to be? Because I tell you, $3 billion in top line revenue doesn't provide you with any amount of R&D dollars you can use to compete against a juggernaut like AMD or NVIDIA. Where do they get the research dollars from? They don't have them. So maybe even if they take a hit on gross margin, they're going to print more operating income dollars and they're going to have a hell of a lot more capital to invest in R&D. Is that a journey they should take? I think they're thinking about it. There's rumors in the street they are. I think it's a smart move if they're thinking about it. It's going to upset their ecosystem based on past success, like we talked about earlier. But these are the kind of things you're going to see the chiplet dynamic changing. There will be winners. There will be losers, just like the foundry business and the IP business did this to us in the past. You know, being students of history, this isn't going to be a painless process. Some people are going to fall out along the way.
Just to drill one level in deeper, and then we need to close out. But like, ARM would
you
be...
want to know who's going to fail?
No,
to sell their stock.
No,
now, don't
no,
you?
No, no, no. No. Like, the reason ARM would be able to do this now because of the chiplet architecture versus before is because ARM could basically be like, oh, we can actually develop product that could hit a bunch of different end markets with our IP relatively cost effectively because of chiplets. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, you know, that's another fission point. You know, I could probably talk about this without getting in too much trouble, but, you know, Qualcomm and ARM are suing each other right now. So they're not really on good terms right now anyways. But how do you think Qualcomm feels about ARM saying, Qualcomm, instead of you selling $130 modem CPU graphics AI solution into a phone company like Google or Apple or somebody, instead of you doing that, I will make these chips because I'm not going to give you ARM cores anymore. And I'm not going to give you that fundamental AI tech. I won't give you my fabric, my chip, cell libraries. I'm going to bundle it. I'm not going to give it to you. I'm going to make silicon. And for each one of these silicon chips, you need three of them. I'm going to charge you $60. And I'll, you know, margin it up, of course, high margin if I can get away with it. And then what you're going to do is you're going to be an aggregator of these chiplets. And for a service fee and $30, you can take your $130 in sale and average sales price into Apple and Google, and you can make that $30, $40, $50. Not a good discussion to have with between Qualcomm and ARM. So this is what ARM's going to face as they build their business. How do they handle that dynamic? Are the SoC companies, the guys like NVIDIA, AMD, Broadcom, MediaTek, Samsung, Qualcomm, ST, Infineon, are they relegated to a back chair in this business because IP companies can move up as chiplet companies? Going to be interesting to watch.
Since you're mentioning Qualcomm, I have one wild card last question that just came to mind. Microsoft is trying Windows on ARM again, powered by Qualcomm. Is it going to work this time?
Wow, man, that's a really good question. I think it's gotten better. I'm one of these guys, you know, I've been a lawyer, I've done M&A, done big venture capital deals, I've assembled business, I've shut down businesses. So I think I'm a realist when it comes to statistics. I never say never. I never say I can guarantee you that's going to happen. But what I can tell you, it's like playing blackjack. The odds of ARM working in those areas has gone up. But as we discussed earlier, what's chasing them on their heels is a RISC-V open business model that offers a lot of advantages to customers that if ARM's not careful, they're going to pay for all of the porting and conversion off of other platforms to them just to have another RISC architecture called RISC-V waltzing behind them with far lower switching costs than they had to deal with and take their TAM. If I'm over there at their company on the board, that's what I'm thinking about. And I'm trying to figure out what does that mean for me.
So maybe ARM, maybe RISC-V, doesn't sound like x86.
Well, x86 always struggled. And in which you were talking about which product from Microsoft?
Windows, PCs.
Oh, PCs. I still think the PC space, if you got to be backward compatible all the way back to DOS and everything, the validation suite for these processors is probably more important than the RTL design itself, right? Kind of like the weights in an AI algorithm, once it's trained, may actually be more valuable to a company than the algorithm itself, right? So you have to watch the value. new platforms that don't have a lot of legacy are more ripe for porting over to a newer, you know, more fashionable platform. So the PC may be hard, but I'll tell you this. Intel has had a problem with making efficient processors. ARM is much better at building efficient processors. So if a use case dimension like battery life becomes way more important for people, you remember all the faltering Intel experience trying to do Atom and these processors low power, getting them into low power devices like tablets and phones. They're going to still experience that in other markets, again, because they were focused on big iron servers. Their entire fab history was tuned to do that and do that well. They were the best. I competed against them when we owned, you know, Fab 32 and 38 at AMD, and they would crush people into the ground with their superiority in fab technology. So, but it was high performance, high power. That game doesn't fly in cell phones, watches, and a lot of the IoT devices. So this is where the Achilles heel is and where ARM can get a leg up, because ARM, and Intel's getting smart about this too. Intel's going to TSMC and others, but ARM can go into TSMC with more low power honed devices with maybe a more efficient architecture. And if that matters in a PC or a tablet, well, ARM has most of the tablets anyways, but if that matters in a PC, they can climb that stack. It's much more likely now than what it was, I would say, 10 years ago.
Okay. Well, with that, thank you so much, Keith. This was very illuminating and interesting, and we will look forward to seeing TensorTorrent products and data centers and endpoint devices and all over the place over the coming years.
Well, Brett and Frank, I wanted to thank you for having me on this podcast. I really enjoyed the conversation. The next time we do this, I promise you, one of my character flaws is my wife tells me I talk too much. So the next time we talk, I promise I'll listen and learn more from you than what I did on this call because I talk so much. So I'm very, very much looking forward to the next time we speak. And thank you for inviting me on this show.
Sure. This is not a therapy session. You don't need to listen so much. We had you on to talk, to hear from you. Okay. All right. Thanks, Keith. Good to see you. Thank you so much for joining FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. I hope you learned a lot about AI chips and kind of the jockeying within the chip ecosystem. We think it's a multi-trillion dollar opportunity, you know, measured over the course of the decade, and that it's a strategic game board that's in a lot of flux today with a dominant player in NVIDIA that has extremely high gross margins, you know, higher than is normal in this space. And that opens up a lot of opportunity for up-and-comers to kind of carve out competitive niches and maybe scrape out strategic footprints that can become very large. So please like and subscribe, tell everybody about the show, rate us 5 stars, and we'll see you next week.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.